The Arab Film Festival celebrates its 11th anniversary with more than 80 exclusive films from and about the Arab world. The festival runs from October 18th to the 28th in San Francisco, Berkeley, and San Jose. See the first Lebanese vampire movie, a Jordanian documentary about finding peace through skateboarding, and the latest film from acclaimed Palestinian actor-director Mohammed Bakri. For more information, call 415-564-1100 or visit our website at www.aff.org. KPFA is a media sponsor.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is a minute past 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So today is the new moon in Libra. We are swinging back into balance and respect and mending broken treaties. It's Eleanor Roosevelt's birthday, and fellow Libran Doris Lessing just won the Nobel Prize in Literature in her novel Shikasta, all about kind of post-apocalypse. How do we come through the environmental everything crisis of now and out? That, though wise Canopians say, we have no plan, we simply feel what is needed and respond. And someone once asked her, how do we prepare for chaos and crisis? She said, place yourself in situations that require improvisation. And we say, well, we're all in that right now, in this fluctuating wild force field. So the new moon in Libra, it trines 120 degree angle to Neptune, dreams, vision, imagination, the ocean and the sea. And it reminds us that our alliance with the ocean, healing the ocean, making alliance with the ocean, heals our imagination. And only the healing of our imagination can guide us to collaborating and healing the sea. So more than perfectly, we are joined this week by longtime ally, marine acoustician Michael Stocker, whose website is www.ocr.org, and senior scientist at the Ocean Conservancy, ardent ocean activist Wallace J. Nichols. His website is wallacejnichols.org. That's J, just the letter. That our willingness and wonder to work with the seas may eclipse our rudeness as a species at this wild time of fluctuating force fields where all stories can be changed. And we are all of us presenting at Bioneers next weekend, October 19th through the 21st. And you can find out more about that at bioneers.org. But welcome, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Caroline?
And welcome, Wallace J. Nichols.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good.
Good to be on the radio with you guys.
That's wonderful. Now, I know that we only have a precious 12 minutes of you before you go off to inform countless other beings. So let's dive in. You were just communing with humpback whales.
I was. I literally just stepped back onto dry land after spending the morning out on floating around in the Monterey Bay with humpback whales, rissos, dolphins, and a whole bunch of sea lions, and it was a beautiful morning.
Wonderful. So, and you're also, well, you're devoted to the sea and also to turtles and turtle medicine. And when speaking to Michael, you're saying, well, okay, there's much that is dire that we know about, but also what is heartening, the resilience of the ocean, the resilience of the sea. Might you guide us to kind of feel humpback whale medicine?
Well, that's absolutely right. I think when we give the ocean a chance, it thrives and it bounces from the damage that we do. And we see that all over. We see that with the whales, various species of whales that are making comeback. We see it with sea turtles. We see it with reefs. We see it with invertebrates. We see it with fisheries. And we need to just figure out how to give the ocean the chance to come back. It's been taking taking what we've been dishing out for quite a long time, and what we put into the ocean and what we take out of the ocean. We've been taking too much and dumping too much, and the ocean just needs a break, a breather from all of our activities. And lots of people are working on that around the globe and creating an ocean revolution. And Michael and I are part of that.
Absolutely. And Michael, you were saying that humpback whales are kind of the embodiment of joy.
Yeah, of course, if you've ever seen one jump out of the water, and of course it's a behavior, but beyond a behavior, it's really a fabulous thing to see these huge, giant animals just completely clearing the water and just splashing down. And all you can say is, they must be happy.
Yeah, it elicits that in us. Jay Nichols, I've had some profound times with sea turtles, I like this idea of, if we treat things well, they all kinds of gifts open up. I once protected a sea turtle from harassing tourists in Hawaii, and then it swam in front of me, and I swear, looking back, making sure I was following, and we went around and around, and then we came to this giant cavern underwater with just a gazillion sea turtles wafting, and it was as though it said, "You did me a favor, I'll take you to Sea Turtle World." what do you think about, alliances? How are the sea turtles doing, and what can we do?
Well, the idea of keeping ourselves separate from nature is really part of the problem. I think I just met a handful more people today while we were out looking at humpback whales who they wanted to talk about sea turtles too. And they wanted to talk about their experience in the ocean with sea turtles. And that's a big part of fixing some of these problems is people connecting with these animals. And sea turtles are great, great animals to connect with. They'll hang out with you in the water. You can swim with them and swim around them and follow them, and they'll even follow you. Taking that experience out of the water, back onto land, and turning it into the actions that we need to make the ocean a safer place for all these animals is really important. And I meet people all over the world who tell similar stories about getting into the ocean and then losing track of time. And spending hours, many hours in the water, and then coming out of the water feeling ready to take on the world. So finding the inspiration from these animals is nothing new. People have always found inspiration, in nature and in particular from turtles, from sea turtles. Indigenous cultures around the world have, beautiful and amazing stories. Songs and poetry that connects them with these animals. And no doubt that's a big part of how we're going to find the way to protect them is just by getting to know them a little bit better and then working on their behalf.
And you work a lot with kids too, yeah?
Yes, I find the kids are extremely open to these kinds of conversations and they love the ocean. They love sea turtles. They love dinosaurs. And sea turtles are kind of our living closest thing to a dinosaur. And it's really great to sit around with kids and talk about sea turtles and share stories and educate each other about how important they are. And connecting kids with each other, connecting kids around the world. And we work with young ocean activists and leaders in their communities and try to connect them with each other so that they don't feel alone. Because many of them are working in places far away from support, far away from other ocean activists, and it's really important that they feel like they're part of a global movement. And so that's a big part of the work of Ocean Revolution is connecting young ocean activists with each other and giving them the tools to do their jobs.
Yeah, I think that is crucial, the vision that can unite us all. I mean, one of the incredibly tragic aspects of the bombing of Lebanon summer ago was the huge oil spill, and the ocean environmentalists in Lebanon and in Israel were not permitted to collaborate with each other. And in fact, the Israeli government didn't let anybody start cleanup for an egregiously long time, but they yearned to collaborate. So this idea of, again, a global sense of, yes, we are going to cross these artificial borders. I mean, land has boundaries, but ocean has none. And I gather from your ebullience that you feel like, okay, we can do this. We can save oceans, even though so much is dire. I mean, you are metabolizing your despair.
Yeah, it's remaining optimistic and just doing it. And you know, I think you touched on an important point. It's one ocean. You know, a molecule of water in our ocean can move around, can go anywhere. There are no barriers. The ocean flows around the planet, and over time it just keeps mixing. And you know, we know that from physics. We know it from biology. We've tracked turtles all around the ocean, from one side to the other. And we need to work together. We need to cross these political boundaries that are completely artificial, with regard to what's going on in the ocean. And we need to start solving these problems as one group of human beings, and treating the ocean as one ocean. And you know, the tools that we have are, you know, the internet has really made a big difference, but it's the internet connected with real experiences, the real ocean, the real whales, the real turtles, and then using the internet to help people communicate with each other. But I always encourage the young people I work with to use the internet, share what you need to share, and turn it off. And get back in the ocean, or get back out on the coast, and be with it, and learn, and come back and share that. And it's fun too. You know, I think that's a part of it. It's a part of this. The work of this movement is to always find time for fun and for play. And you know, we're out there today on the Monterey Bay, looking at these humpback whales. And like Michael said, we found this humpback whale who was hanging out and playing with some drifting kelp. And we just cut the engine of the boat and sat there for half an hour and watched this whale play just a few feet away from us. And it was just playing with the kelp. There's no better description to what the whale was doing. And we were lucky just to be there watching the whale play. And for us, that was a sort of play. So that's the fuel of this movement, is those experiences and playing and having fun together, having fun with these animals in their midst, and getting rejuvenated and fired up to do this work, because Lord knows it's can be really hard sometimes and heartbreaking, and you need to be re-energized frequently. And I think it's important to have fun, and the ocean's a fun place.
and I think part of the fun, I think, available to the poetic and your informed wonder self is, I mean, we're always kind of cutting deals, too, going, you know, when I encounter animals in the wild, they seem to be sending emissaries, and I say, some of us are trying to be less rude, you know, okay. And it's like, well, we get to enjoy seeing the whales, and then there isn't, you know, a joyful obligation to respond. Yeah, I mean, that's really what you're dedicated to respond in kind, going, oh, such joy, we will, you know, here's our part of the deal. I saw on your website that you're, you know, on the board of about a gazillion different, dedicated to ocean organizations, which is fabulous, including, we don't have quite time to go into it, but I'll go into some of these things with Michael about, you know, shrimpsuck.org, which is why we should not eat shrimp, and to go, okay, that's an important kind of part of the deal, you know, cutting the deal too. But I mean, when you see the humpback whales and the turtles, and you go, okay, here's a deal, thank you, and I am dedicating this part of my life to, you know, all these things. The humpback whale today, is there a deal in motion? You go, oh, playing with kelp, I vow to therefore be, you know, Wallace J. Nichols, to be more playful, to be more dedicated, to be a voice. I mean, I think that's part of the deal, you know, to be a voice for those things that don't have a voice in the human community. But, you know, our friend Carolyn Raffensperger last week said, you know, that when we're voting, it's a parliament of 64 million species. I mean, we're, you know, wherever our affinities lie. So when you vote, I mean, you're voting for the humpback whales and the turtles and all those guys.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, I've been out on that patch of water many times and seen those whales. And someone asked me, you know, do you do this a lot? And I said, well, not enough, never enough. It's needed. You need to just disconnect and get out and be with nature. And I think, the more we can help people do that, have a, you know, an eye-to-eye experience, of course, in the most careful way, so not harming the animals that we're loving, but to have an eye-to-eye experience with a wild creature, whether it's in the ocean or in the forest, is extremely important. And you take things away from those interactions that just propel you on to this work. And and I can feel how my mind and my heart is going when I've been away from the ocean for too long, or in an office or on my computer for too long, and it just kind of calls you back to get that fuel. And people who love the ocean know that, and people who don't know that yet can know it by just getting out there. And I want to pass the baton on to Michael, because he has a lot of things to tell you about, and in doing so, said Michael's organization is one of the organizations I proudly serve as an advisor, and he's doing important work with regard to sound in the ocean and the problems that animals like whales face in a noisy ocean. So I hope you had a lot of time to chat about that, and also definitely have Michael tell you about shrimp, the reality of shrimp, our number one seafood in the United States, and the most destructive.
We do need to, and I am protectively watching the clock on your behalf, too, because I know there's an audience waiting for you at another place, but we will reconvene at Bioneers then.
Yes, look forward to that.
Okay, thank you again for your informed wonder.
Look forward to seeing you next week.
All right, so long. See you guys soon.
Yeah, okay, see you soon. Thanks. That's great. So yeah, the eye-to-eye contact, and I don't know, Michael, if you know the wonderful Wendell Berry poem in which he's saying, you know, when the grief of the world is too much with me, I go and lie down with the woodrake to be with animals who do not burden themselves with forethought of grief. And I was talking to Carolyn Raffensperger, though, going, sometimes I worry now that they are burdened with forethought of grief. I mean, do you think creatures have a sense of anticipatory dread, or that things are out of whack? Or do you think the joy of immediacy, you know, for the humpback whales is, I don't know, what do you think?
Well, there's obviously a synergistic effect that's hard to measure, but we see it in terms of the physiological effects on fish and dolphins and what have you when they're being stressed out by circumstances. They'll, of course, like human beings, start, getting little sicknesses, disease, ulcers, problems with their cancers and what have you. So we're seeing a little bit more of that, of course, in the past 20 or 30 years. I remember maybe it was about 20 years ago I was out fishing and caught a smelt. It was a real beautiful sized smelt, but it was, the texture of the meat inside was like, it was so, it was just so cancerous. It was strange to see a fish that usually see it, that these have very kind of clear, whitish meat inside. It's very pure, and this was just lumpy. And this is in Los Angeles Harbor, so I can only imagine that it might have been a product of the stresses, the chemical stresses that it was subjected to. On the other hand, though, I have a picture right in front of me of from Umas Kaldir, who's sent it down, that might be able to use it for our booth down at Bioneers. But it is a picture of a humpback whale with a bottlenose dolphin balanced on its nose. And they're obviously playing. They're just laying down. So, you know, there are moments out there, you know, that these animals are not necessarily pondering the weight of the decisions of man. They're just responding to their environment.
Yeah, and since we are in this new moon Libra, somebody sent me an anonymous quote that just said, peace, it does not mean to be in a place where there is no noise, trouble, or hard work. It means to be in the midst of those things and still be calm and playful in your heart. So it's like, may it be so.
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking backstage in the green room, and we remember that the green room, it comes from the backstage term green room comes from Greek theater. And it was called The Green Room because it was sacred to Dionysus, the green man. So each actor in theater, when it was still remembered to be sacred, was backstage dedicating themselves to green, I guess we could call it the blue room too, to the world of nature, before they went on stage, no matter how secular or tragic the theatrical endeavor. It always started with that. So that's kind of what, you know, here we are, all of us, you know, we're in a sense in the green room. And it is, just to weave a little more context for us right now. So Mercury is stationing and will retrograde tonight, 9 p.m. California time until November 1st, All Souls Day, of the Day of the Dead. And the image for Mercury right now at its stationing degree, when it beams down, you know, what is the manner of communicating? What do we want to do with our fellow humans and also our fellow creators and creatures and rocks and tree people and everybody? And so the image is a fellowship supper reunites old comrades. And I love that idea, that this particular retrograde right now, this season we're heading into, is about reconnecting. Fellowship supper reunites old comrades. So it's, you know, it's the Bioneers crew, it's you, it's the humpback whales, it's the whatever, the reshuffling. And I mentioned to you backstage that Jupiter squares Uranus, storytelling and change, you know, and it is this radical, improvisational, fluctuating force field in which all stories can be changed. Like, whoa, you know. So we say, what stories do we want to change? You also said backstage that, you know, that there were many great things to celebrate. We know that, you know, activists and informed people, it's often the burden, we are burdened with forethought of grief. Like, but the animals and the sea that we love don't really want us to be that way. And you were saying that you had a harvest in your fishing net of, you know, positive directions.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm seeing things. I've been working on ocean environmentalism for about 15 years now. Initially, I got into it because of the hints and potential threats of global warming was causing scientists to want to sonify the ocean to see if it somehow was able to measure the rise in ocean temperature through sound, and they of course could do that, but it alerted me to it was the camel's nose under the tent, so to speak, when all of a sudden they were broadcasting noises across thousands of miles of ocean. I was going, wait a second, that's not necessary, it doesn't sound too good to me. So I started looking at the problem at that point. And when I was initially talking to people about ocean noise pollution, I mean, people would say, what do you mean, the waves are bothering people? Because the ocean was largely thought of as a silent place. And it has been in the past maybe 5 or 6 years due to, you know, the work of a number of different advocates on this issue, and also unfortunate occurrences with whale strandings, and but also people like you know, Jay or Ann Rowley, who are really reaching out to large audiences and conveying the idea that the ocean is something that we don't necessarily need to caretake, but we need to take care of. We need to take care of our relationship to it. And so more and more people are talking about the ocean, even some of the more abstract aspects of it. I mean, I was down in New Orleans a couple of years ago at a conference, and I was asked by a young waiter at a restaurant, you know, what brings you down to New Orleans? And I talked about the ocean noise issue. And the next thing I knew, he and three other waitresses were around my table telling me what was going wrong with this thing. And I'm delighted because they're so informed about the issues. And that's happening more and more. Our actions are being informed by that. We just reauthorized the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act. This year, it's got a long pedigree, but they're keep on trimming it and tailoring it so that we actually have scientific input that's not completely gated and censored by industrial desire. And we're starting to see people to really take actions. Marine protected areas are a whole program going along the coast of California right now to really look at how do we maintain not just specific species. We can't look at the ocean as if they were broccoli and Brussels sprouts and tomatoes that are growing in little boxes or little truck farms. It's a whole ecosystem. So ecosystem-based management is an idea that is starting to get a lot of fluency. And these types of ideas, bringing generalists to the table as opposed to people who are really specific about one thing, you can actually now understand really clearly how the shark saves the coral. And not see the shark merely as a source of protein or a threat or you know, a competition for fishermen. It's actually something that, you know, as the sharks, if they become depleted, then the parrotfish blossom and they start eating the coral up. So the sharks actually keep the parrotfish down, which keeps a balance between the coral and the parrotfish. That's just
well, I know that. I know that. Yeah, and I know at the Blue Salon in Washington D.C., Alexandra Cousteau, daughter of famous guy, you know, she's particularly, I guess. We're devoted to the whole thing. I mean, all of us, but everybody's got an assignment. So she's particularly devoted to the sharks and their plight, you know, and the being mean to shark. I mean, the shark fin soup, the cutting off of the fin and throwing them back to die in agony, and the depletion, and the relationship to the corals as well. So that's her. She's in love with the sharks. That she is their agent.
There's some shark stuff coming out. Mike Schramm is creating a movie called Shark Water, which is coming out in the fall. And he is actually down there realizing the sharks are curious, just like dolphins, like turtles and what have you. And if you're not fearful, if fear doesn't come into the equation, the sharks will come and check you out curiously. And what's going on? And he says,
"Yeah, well, that's an important part we want to put on our work table too, because I was telling you about kerfuffles and dog fights and things I've been involved with, and you said respect for danger, and I was saying yes, let respect trump fear, what a good idea. We want to be have respect for danger but not fear it necessarily, which would be very Aikido as well. And so, yeah, I know the people of Molokai, the most indigenous of the Hawaiian Islands. Their amakua is sharks, and I talk to many indigenous people of Molokai. They go swim with them regularly, and I do remember this great scene. Walking on a beach, and there was a beached hammerhead shark, and it was in trouble. And this, Hawaiian man was, walking it to the water until, with this incredible shudder, like, vah, 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 it came alive, like, vum, like incredible vitality, like, oh my God, and went swim, vum, 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 and swam away. And he said, it's a courtesy. I like to swim out to that rock in the summer, and there's a lot of hammerheads, and now I've got credit.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Wow, the awesome vitality of like unconscious, like whoa, and the respect for danger to bring that, to help that and bring it back to life. Ooh, yes, really, really good. And oh, yes.
Well, I'm just thinking though. I just wanted to tease out this. There's a distinction between respect for danger and fear. I was thinking, I was coming over here today, that, fear is a biological reaction. It's what happens when something's inside your perimeter. All of a sudden, the cortisol levels go up, your pancreas goes in, everything goes crazy, and you react. Whereas respect for danger, and this was, our original conversation came out of a paper that was in Nature magazine last week about mice in the wild and certain experiments we're doing in Russia with these animals. And realizing that it wasn't necessarily the smart mice that prevailed, but it was the ones that respected danger. It's not a living in fear. It's understanding that there's danger out there.
Well, I think this is, we want to tease this into everywhere too, because one of the themes we're all working on and that I like to animate is, what in us serves freedom and what serves tyranny in micro ways of internally and how we relate and then what we serve in the world. So we say to react to anything really is not free, but to cultivate a repertoire of responses, which then we link that also to respect, is to be allied with kind of nature's democracy, with nature's evolutionary force of freedom. So I go, I know there's a lot in here, this crucial thing, but and I was telling you about kerfuffle might go into a little more when we come back from break, but how do we release these things? And in the wild, when animals are surged with adrenaline, like they say a deer being hunted by a lion, if it's lucky enough to escape, it shudders all over, like, and then it goes back fear-free to munching grass. And a number of research doctors have said humans have lost their capacity to metabolize the adrenaline, or they've forgotten. But you need to dance, or to tremble, or to take aconite. I mean, we'll come back on that one too. How do you release the past trauma so that we are increasingly responsive and not reactive? But yes. So our guest today is the always wonderful Michael Stocker, and we did have a smidge early on of Wallace J. Nichols, and I'm Caroline Casey, and we will all be presenting at Bioneers next weekend, October 19th, 20th, 21st. And what do you have lined up for us for our break? What songs are we going to hear?
You know, I was had this Humpback and Minky Wales with an Earthquake on it. I was going to ask that Erica play that, but I have a Bearded Seal here that is about a 35-second cut of a Bearded Seal. It's the most incredible sound, and it might be a great thing to have as a break. So does it sound okay?
Let's do that.
Okay, give me the cue, and then we'll do it.
The cue is now.
There we go. That's going to take us. It should be coming in.
I don't want to talk over it, but
it should be coming in on input 5.
Okay, but I can also say that after this little short break, you can join us afterwards by calling 510-848-4425, and a Bearded Seal is coming our way. Coming. Perhaps. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey, then, and our guest today is Michael Stocker, and that was, tell us,
a Bearded Seal. I mean, why did they do that? Actually, there was probably a couple others in the background there,
but what are they doing?
They're just trying to blow our heads. That's all I can figure out.
Where are they?
This is an Antarctic.
Where was that recorded?
In the Arctic.
Another reason to be precious of everywhere, the Antarctic. What a great sound from such a far place. And it's true, it gives us, you know, goose skin. It's like, ooh, yeah. Well, that's great. Well, yeah, and also as we cavort along here, aspiring to be, you know, well, we aspire to be humpback whales, but also I want a little Bearded Seal in my mix too, going woohoo, woo. That's a really fabulously moving, spooky sound. But also, you can feel free at your end to bring in the sounds of whales as you want to and fro whenever you feel moved to do that. But the Bearded Seal, that's their song. Do we know more about what they're...
You know, it's just really, as I understand it, it's only been the past maybe 5 or 6 years that they've been really looking at these seals. And they didn't believe that these animals, because they're amphibious, you know, we mostly see them above water. And so with the sounds that we have of these animals are like, you know, they're barking and they're grunts and what have you. But it's only been recently that people have realize that these sounds are coming from these creatures, that they're not just, they're, you know, like sirens in the water. So what do they do?
Well,
with them?
I think...
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, these ambassadors that are so crucial, you know, when I had Healing the Human-Insect Relationship, Joanne Locke, on years ago, and I still remember it with great love, she said, you know, we kill what we don't understand or don't know about. And so she goes around educating people about, you know, the marvels, extraordinary, of insects. And she does a great job from the micro to the macro. If we kill what we don't understand, and everybody sort of encourages that, like, ooh, you know, squishy, squeamy, oh, step on the insect, or, ooh, you know, sea thing, you know, then it's right out to the Iraq War and torture. So the more we know, the more we hear Bearded Seals, the more we hear the song, and the more, because that was such a spooky sound. I want more. That was such a spooky sound that you go, whoo, whatever made this is worthy of respect, and again, respect, not only does respect trump fear, but really does really encourage our responsiveness. And I think, part of our sense of kinship and relatedness, like, what a planet, what a planet, one of the best campsites like ever, God, and it is so beautiful and full of wonder, and how could we be so rude? We've got to snap out of this thing. And so I guess there is no low frequency sonar in the Antarctic to trouble the bearded seals. But we've
not so fast. It's on its way. Yeah.
Okay. Well, give us the dire report that we can again be respectful and responsive, because we've done many shows with you on the low frequency sonar and this incredible rudeness. Oh, humans just. So where are we now? I remember when I was overseas reading some dire thing that had been reinstated because terror is trumping everybody's, fear is eclipsing respect, and we want to tip that balance back. So what's the latest dire disaster?
Well, I mean, it's not a disaster, it's in play. But the Navy has been given provisional permission to go ahead with insonifying 80% of the oceans with low frequency active sonar, which is kind of an ongoing. I have a little bit of something that would.
Okay.
I think I've got a LFAS simulation. It sounds a little bit like this is a simulation, but it passes mustard with the Navy here. Is it coming up on your end, Eric? Oh. Okay.
Oh, that's really rude.
Label sound.
That's really.
It's kind of. But it's in pause. I mean, the whole way that particular permission was given, the public was given a 15-day comment period, and so it's going back. It's not really happening. It's still in play and review. The Navy really wants this very badly. They can taste it. A 15-day comment period for something of global consequence. I don't know who gave National Marine Fisheries Service jurisdiction over the entire planetary ocean, but they've taken it in this particular case.
And then again, it's like, well, we need everything carte blanche because of terror, because we have to track submarines that were all rusting, and the Russian fleet is no good, but we have to because we're unsupervised boys. I mean,
they have some fancy toys, and it's and unfortunately, they're getting more and more, nasty. I mean, the animals, like the bearded seal, communicates in a beautiful way underwater. And I've got another communication sound of beluga whales. This is one that also just tickles me. Here, if. Okay, those are beluga whales. And
that's like transmission from outer space.
A little bit, and if you look at the or inner space or these animals are hunting cooperatively. They have real complex vocalizations that allow them to strategize with each other. And we're essentially doing the same type of thing in our naval exercises, except the sounds we're using are a little bit different. It's more like pull your mic down a little bit on it, because this is a
sonar. You're gonna do it to us again.
A sonar signal. This is our equivalent to the belugas. It's more like a fingernail scratching a blackboard.
Well, it's so, we humans are, it's so primitive, it's so mean, it's so rude, and I have to say that you've played the low frequency sonar before in the air, and a wonderful listener who said, I love your shows, and I love the Michael Stocker and the wonderful sounds of the whales. But when you put the low frequency sonar sound, she said her dog got up, and hackles, and had to hunt the room for what evil thing had made this sound. She said her dog was really traumatized. So we apologize to, we apologize spiraling on out. We apologize to everything. Actually, we apologize to the dog listening. We apologize to the creatures in the ocean that we're doing this to, because these sonar, low-frequency sonar blasts, I mean, we just got a little bit, which is like, they go on for a long time, yeah?
The ping, they call it a ping. It's kind of a strange word to use, but the pings are usually about 100 seconds in length. They'll duty cycle maybe 20 to 40%, meaning 100 seconds on to the 200 seconds or 300 seconds off, hours at a stretch. It's really definitely all over the place. And that's only one, you know, platform source, mid-frequency sonars, the low-frequency sonars, we do not see any evidence of catastrophic damage. But it's in the same sense that, you know, when they put a freeway in your backyard, you don't keel over and die. But there's a high probability that it does alter or mask your communication with other conspecifics or the ability to be able to hear the birds or what have you.
We're going to get to other rude noises that humans make that we want to, but to pause, because so many people have been alerted to this largely by you, I mean, in many ways. And so what can we now do now about the imminent?
Well, I mean, stay alert to the machinations of the Navy. I mean, one of the reasons why I put together ocean conservation research was because I was at a conference last year, and Acoustic Society conference, and about 90% of the papers on ocean bioacoustics were funded by the Navy. Now, that doesn't make it bad science. It's good science. These people are really highly qualified and very respected people, and I hold them in real high regard. The challenge here is that they are being paid to research things that are the Navy's priorities, such as recoverable auditory thresholds and not the priorities that I feel are important, which are, you know, what are the biological thresholds? At what point do animals start responding to the sounds, and in what way? Because as I was mentioning, there's no real evidence that the low-frequency sonar is damaging animals, but, you know, we maybe need to look with a little bit wider scope. On the other hand, the mid-frequency sonars, which we do know cause catastrophic strandings of whales, and we don't know what impacts they have on other animals. But if we could craft those mid-frequency sounds like that C-53, or I'm going to do this is a slightly obnoxious frequency shift key signal that's used in sonar. And it's so, would you rather hear that, or would you rather hear the belugas? So my conceit is, yes, if we look at the way nature has taken care of these problems of, you know, short distance strategic communication for hunting purposes, which is exactly what the military is doing with a lot of these things, if we look at the sounds the animals are making and maybe craft our noises a little bit more like their noises, it may not be as damaging. In fact, they can get their mission accomplished without having to compromise, you know, their security or the safety of the animals in the ocean. So that's kind of where we're heading. Now, this is all at this point in time, it's theoretical. We haven't really teased a lot of the information systems out of this, but it's something that's worth heading in that direction. I think we can be informed by nature again.
Yes, well, absolutely. I mean, that is the huge thing that is, you know, quickening, I think, in everyone's soul, and that, you know, pioneers, many of the people who gather there at that conference where actual conferring takes place, you know, the whole realm of biomimicry, Janine Benyus says, you know, to borrow from nature her recipes, not to steal, you know, and go, oh, yeah, because human technology is largely toxic, heat-beaten treat, she says, but nature can't afford that poison because it's working with living things. And so again, we're back to, yeah, may respect trump fear and respect and art. I mean, we're in the new moon in Libra. Respect and art, you know, trump tyranny, you know, and how do we can tease this into all of us? Yeah, so there's that, and then you were going to go on to more rudeness, I think, the level of noise in the ocean and what we can do about it, and there's vortex technology and
machines. It's increasing at a grand clip, and it's not just, I mean, the shipping noises because of transcontinental shipping, globalization of commerce and what have you. A lot of the Navy noises that are happening are a product also of globalization, as much as that they're protecting the cargo fleets that are coming through Oceania and wherever else they're going. Those shipping lanes need to be kept open. As a consequence, the noise level in the ocean is 10 times louder now than it was 50 years ago, and that's just with the shipping noise. And now we're starting to set all these different remotely operated vessels into the water that are communicating through acoustic modems to transponders at satellite uplinks. And so where all of a sudden these nasty, like that frequency shift key signal was actually communication signals used to convey, you know, text information from one place to the other underwater.
On, by whom? I mean,
well, this particular one's a Navy and Coast Guard. So,
but so is there any reason for responsible people who aspire to be ever more reverent to like go on a cruise ship?
I think like, it would be good to go out in the ocean, just generally, you know, and to get a feel.
So
for
cruise ships not toxic intrinsically?
Well,
the noise, the pollution, the.
They're there. I mean, if we doubled the ship, you know, right now Lloyd's of London has some 85,000 ships registered that are commercial boats registered, and if we doubled that, we would only increase the noise level in the ocean by 3 dB. It's not a significant amount, but the other sources of noise, underwater communication systems, the scientific exploration, the seismic air gun blasting—that's another one. That's you know, looking for oil. All these things
say just a little more about that. Okay, seismic air gun blasting.
Well, in order to determine where oil is in the water, and they're getting deeper and deeper off into the shelves and off, you know, off the shelves here, they use seismic air guns, which are these explosions which kick an acoustic impulse down into the substrate below the ocean bottom, and they can read the reflections and determine if there's oil deposits down there. These explosions are particularly loud. You can hear them 1,500 to 2,000 miles away in the ocean, and they usually have a repeat rate of anywhere from every 10 to 15 seconds, and they go on for hours on end.
And where are they mostly happening? Is that the Arctic?
They are mostly happening everywhere in the ocean. This month, there are 37 projects going on right now this month that are doing seismic work, and it's you know, in the Gulf, it's up in the Arctic, it's in, you know, throughout the Sakhalin. There's a big problem right now up in Sakhalin area, in kind of north, above Korea, in up in Russia, where they're, you know, putting oil fields down there, and that's really the last kind of resting area of the western gray whales, and they're people who are paying attention to it, and it's not a total disaster, not just going in there and bludgeoning the thing, but it is a problem because they're doing air gun work there, and the thirst for oil is edging out the passion for nature and the saving these animals, which there are not a lot left of those particular group of gray whales. So,
again, more incentive for all of us going, since we've got to make the switch anyway from oil to ingenuity, why not do it before we kill everything? And also while we've still got a 24/7 kind of working grid. So it's like, okay, more incentive, you know, more knowledge. Because we know how noise makes us crazy. You've done a splendid job in past shows of, you know, delineating for us that, you know, that there's the spectacular beachings of the charismatic mammals and so on, but that, you know, you say also that a lot of them, what they die of is brain hemorrhage, and many creatures may just sink into the ocean from hemorrhage.
We have no idea how many we lose in these situations. Yeah, the ones that beach because they're close enough to get to the beaches. The other ones, who knows? I mean, I remember a few years ago, a beaked whale, Blainsville beaked whale, washed up on the shore in San Francisco. And it had been probably dead for about 4 or 5 days. It was pretty well decomposed, and there wasn't any real clear way of determining what the cause of its death was. But because beaked whales seem particularly sensitive to mid-frequency sonar, that was the assumption, and I was pulled down and had a conversation with some people about that. But we don't know about what happens to fish or other animals that sink to the bottom or in the middle of the sea. We don't really have... I mean,
we know even from the micro little blast and things that you've been affording us of the sound, we know how angry and crazy a little micro homeopathic dose of that makes us feel. Like, you know, again, the hum, you know, it's back to Doris Lessing for a moment, who won the Nobel Prize today, and I think in literature, and I think that's so great. You know, she posited in Shikasta, I think one of her finest novels, you know, that it's her name for planet Earth, and on Shikasta here, there are, she posits, three main colonizing forces. And there's Shamat, and Shamat feeds on that sound. Shamat was the force of kind of up to no good disharmony, and it feeds on the hum of the nuclear power plant, and it feeds on exactly what you've been playing for. It's like, and then there's the Syrians, who are kind of like the World Bank bureaucrats, and they come and make experiments and kind of screw up, and they're kind of liberals, and they don't care, and they go away. Then there's the Canopians, who are the wise, you know, part of ourselves, really, that say that we have no plan, we simply respond with respect whenever possible, and we do not trade in failure. So it's a great novel. I don't know if you've ever read
it. No, I haven't. But it's
oh well, it's,
sounds like
it's
it has all
too
the
timely.
The elements.
It's all too.
Yeah.
It's all too timely and really, and it's such great news actually that she won the Nobel Prize in Literature. I've loved her as a fellow Libran, and her work, because it's been dedicated to all these issues that we're talking about for the longest time with, you know, with Sufi grace. And I was talking to our trickster ally, David Grimes, backstage last night, and he was saying, well, if I wanted to call myself anything, and I don't, you know, it would be Sufism. And I go, yeah, it really is. You know, the shimmering dance that is always there, you know, the Sufi song that says, arise, my love, the atoms are dancing in molecular ecstasy. Come, we will join them. And that's really the opposite of what you're, you know, the sounds that, you know, humans are making in a big way in the ocean. But the bearded seal, for instance, and we might need to hear that again, but the bearded seal, you go, ooh, yes, I mean, haunting, you know, amazing, we might, you know, let's go join them. The atoms are dancing in molecular ecstasy in a really trippy way with those bearded seals. But are there other sounds that, as an antidote to the sonar sounds that you've been playing little snippets of that you might want to treat us to, even bearded seals again, I could go for
it. Yeah, it's a nice one, but you know, there's so, you know, animals in the ocean, I keep on, this is really kind of harping on this, but I don't have a harp seal to harp on it with, but
no, that's great.
It's an acoustic environment, so animals are using it in so many different ways. I mean, I've played some marine mammals, including humans, and but fish make some wacky sounds. I mean, I've got, this is called a carpenter fish, and you can hear why. This is chorusing. It's chorusing of carpenter fish.
What do you mean chorusing? That's a bunch of them.
There's a bunch together? Of them, and they bang around together, and they happen to have this kind
of. What are they banging? I mean, what is?
They're making these sounds with these muscles in their gut.
Oh.
And clicking. It's a it's not anything, you know, and fish are not frequency oriented animals. I mean, mammals are adapted to perceive frequency. That's why we have that cochlea, which gives us a real fine pitch discrimination. Fish don't have those types of organs, so they check things out in the time domain. Again, we don't know, particularly with this kind of arrhythmic banging of the carpenter fish, what they're doing. But chorusing, there are other cynates in this particular family, croakers, that they chorus in like crickets almost. Or you hear this kind of. There was an interesting study that was done quite a few years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, by, I think, David Mann was involved in this. They had a bunch of hydrophones stretched across 25 kilometers of coastline in Southern California, and the croakers were chorusing, but they were chorusing like a stadium wave up and down the coast. Just and what that tells me is that across that 25 kilometer area that they were recording these animals, that the animals down in Tijuana had something that the ones up in San Diego needed to know. They were somehow synchronized.
Right.
Much like crickets, that, you know, it's a community that synchronizes in time, and they can tell things through the synchronization. They can tell things about the health, the size of the community, the extent of it, where the perimeters are, if it's being threatened from the outside. And
I think an important, oh, sorry.
No, that's okay, yeah.
Yeah, but an important part of that, too, is, you know, late-breaking science news, you know, ancient to animals. But they found that iguanas that make no sound, but they listen to the mockingbirds, and the mockingbirds' songs, good, good, good. But the mockingbird warning, the iguanas go, oh, warning, mockingbird. You know, so not only are they communicating, you know, any species communicating with itself, but lots of other species are keyed in to that as well. This, you know, the species that don't make those sounds are relying also, the iguanas relying on the mockingbirds. So this fantastic, intricate, you know, acoustic web to which you are dedicated.
Yeah, I mean, these animals, they have to listen to each other to survive. I mean, I'm sure people, aside from myself, have heard this. There was a blue jay in my neighborhood for a couple of years, and this thing had is aped the sound of a red-tailed hawk, and it had that shriek, that hunting shriek that the red-tailed hawk. And this bird would sit kind of up on a branch, and when one of the cats in the neighborhood would walk by, it would shriek like that, and the cat would go, whoa! What's going on? the blue jay would, I can just see it's going, you know, I got you this time.
Yeah, no, animal humor, it's not, I don't think, anthropomorphism. It is, there is real skill and delight and all of that. They're in this fantastic novel, The Harder They Come, by Michael Thelwell, that I just discovered in a dusty pile, but I can't recommend it highly enough. But the protagonist, you know, is a young boy, and he has a friend's father is a fisherman, and he has a box with a glass bottom, and when he put it in the water, you could see the floor of the sea, the strange shapes and colors of the coral. It was a new and different world of pure white sand with strangely shaped formations in purple, blue, and red, and thousands of fishes, spotted, striped, round, long, red, blue, and such, colors as were never seen on land. You know, and it just, the last little bit says, Masbert, the fisherman, gives a slow, knowing smile. Boy, you never see anything like this, eh? You know, and goes, wonderful, Masbert said, it wonderful to Ras, man. And the two boys and the man were united in a shared wonder and a great sense of well-being. The next moment, a large wave hurled the boat upward over a submerged coral ledge, and Ivan shouted with surprise as he wiped the salt spray from his eyes. Masbert, laughing with pleasure, wrestled the small craft into the spray. That wonderful, too, he drawled softly, wiping his eyes. We go, yeah, wonder. Wonder and well-being. Wonder and well-being derived from the sea. So we're almost on our way out all too soon, but we will be cavorting at Bioneers. But is there anything more you might want to give us as a sound, as a prayer or blessing, a sound coming from you, or a prayer or blessing also from... we should say that your website has great sounds on it, OCR.org. You can hear a lot of these fish sounds there, which are fabulous. But is there anything you want to give us now?
You know, one of the things that awakened us all to the idea that animals in the ocean had songs. I mean, we've known about this for years. And Aaron was rescued, the poet musician was rescued by the dolphins when he was cast into the sea by his shipmates because the dolphins recognized a fellow musician, and they that was 2,000 years ago. But in our era here, we really were awakened by the sound of the humpback whale, the songs of the humpback whale that Roger Payne recorded. And I have a little bit of humpback here, and maybe I should just, it's very short, but it's something that would be
reminiscent. Yeah, let's have a little bit of humpback.
Okay, here we go. That's a short clip of a typically anywhere from a 30 to an hour and a half song cycle. I think it's closer to 45 minutes. These long song cycles, which they are patterns that annually they update and embellish, but they're nonetheless, you know, they're the hits of the season. They all sing these songs.
Because they change.
Yeah, they change over years. But you can tell what year they're singing in because the repertoire is fairly well set for each year.
So can you listen to a humpback whale and go, the 80s were good for humpback whales?
Well, there was a period they called the bel canto period, which was when they were being recorded in the early 70s. Roger Payne recorded it, but there was a when that was brought up, that was called the bel canto period. It was an acoustic society meeting, and I said, well, is there a possibility? There's bel canto because they had a lot of embellishment and all kinds of different squeaks and squeals, and now they don't have that much anymore. And I suggested maybe it's because the noise is keeping them from
it might be, and we're on our way out. There's the sound of the exit strategy music, but it is a delight. Michael Stocker, his website is OCR.org. Thanks always to Margot Kelly, our DC wizardress, and also to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley and Caroline Casey. And I will be out live in California, Open Secret next Thursday, Bioneers that weekend, and live from the mothership KPFA on Thursday. Woof, 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 woof. Blessings to us all. Thank you again, Michael.
Hey, thank you so much, Carol.
Have you noticed that persimmons have finally arrived at the farmer's market? Just like persimmons, KPFA is a sure sign of the bounty of Northern California, supported and nurtured in the richness of our community. Come share in this richness during the fall fun drive by volunteering in the KPFA phone room. We could really use your help, and you can become a member of KPFA and get discounts on great KPFA-produced premiums like CDs, DVDs, and T-shirts. Plus, if members of your community group, labor union, or nonprofit come together to volunteer, your organization will be thanked on the air every day you answer phones. So stop by the station at 1929 MLK Junior Way, near the corner of